Today's Wednesday, January 6th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Democrat Raphael Warnock wins one of Georgia's two Senate runoffs.
We prove that with hope, hard work, and the people by our side, anything is possible.
Also ahead, COVID-19 worsens hunger in Zimbabwe.
What we were trying to achieve was the poverty, which was already getting by in my own community.
Plus, President Trump bans transactions with 8 Chinese software applications. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Georgia. Democrat Raphael Warnock has won one of the southern U.S. state's two Senate runoffs. He becomes the first black senator in his state's history and puts the Senate majority within the party's reach. Warnock, a pastor who spent the past 15 years leading the Atlanta church where Martin Luther King Jr. preached, defeated Republican incumbent Kelly Loeffler. The focus now shifts to the second race between David Perdue and Democrat John Ossoff. That contest was too early to call as votes were still being counted. Julie Walker with the Associated Press reports.
Democrat Raphael Warnock won one of Georgia's two Senate runoffs, but his opponent, Republican Kelly Loeffler, is not conceding. Meanwhile, the other race is too close to call. Reverend Warnock becomes the first black senator in Georgia's history and puts the Senate majority within the Democratic Party's reach.
The improbable journey that led me to this place in this historic moment in America could only happen here. We were told that we couldn't win this election.
But Loeffler tells supporters this is a game of inches and she's going to win.
We're
going to
make sure every vote is counted. That's right.
If John Ossoff wins the other runoff, Democrats flip control of the Senate. If David Perdue wins, the Republicans keep it. I'm Julie Walker.
Meanwhile, supporters of President Donald Trump will again gather in Washington today to voice opposition to the outcome of the 2020 election as Congress meets to certify the result. AP correspondent Mike Garcia reports.
How do y'all think the Constitution's worth fighting for?
They were loud and passionate.
Our government should be afraid because we are here to stop the steal of our liberties.
Hundreds of supporters of President Donald Trump gathered in Freedom Plaza in the nation's capital Tuesday to lash out at President-elect Joe Biden's win. The rally was the first of two, with the second today on the Ellipse near the White House, where President Trump will address his supporters. Later, an afternoon march is planned to the U.S. Capitol, where Congress will be voting to affirm the election results. Mike Garcia, Washington.
As Congress meets to certify President-elect Joe Biden's election, President Trump has been pressuring Vice President Mike Pence to act on his behalf today. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The Senate's president, Pence, will preside over the joint session and declare the winner. It's a largely ceremonial role. He has no power to actually affect the outcome. But the president falsely said Pence does have the power to throw out fraudulently chosen voters. Pence will not be the first vice president in an uncomfortable spot. Al Gore presided over the 2000 count that he narrowly lost to George W. Bush.
That's Sagar Magani of AP. Amid the protests, an effort to overturn the presidential election is splitting the Republican Party. We have Sagar Magani again from the Associated Press.
Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz are leading the Senate push. Two potential 2024 presidential contenders vying for President Trump's base. Several other GOP senators are on board, though Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's tried to keep colleagues out of the fight, and several others have blasted the effort, including number two Senate Republican John Thune, who says any objections to the results will go down like a shot dog.
Vasagar Megani of the AP. The Office of the U.S. Director of National Intelligence on Tuesday said Russia was, quote, likely, unquote, behind a string of hacks identified last month that gained access to several federal agencies. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
A string of hacks of U.S. federal agencies and corporations identified last month likely originated in Russia, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence said on Tuesday. A joint statement issued by federal security agencies said the hackers' goal appeared to be collecting intelligence rather than any destructive acts. They said they had identified fewer than 10 agencies that were hacked, although added that the investigation is ongoing and more government victims may be identified. The statement is the first concrete attribution of the incident by the Trump administration. Meanwhile, Russian officials have denied involvement and did not immediately respond to questions. Security company FireEye, which was itself breached, discovered the new round of hacks, many which were later traced to a tainted software update from the network management developer SolarWinds. As many as 18,000 customers downloaded the updates at companies like Microsoft and U.S. federal departments, including Defense, State, Treasury, and Homeland Security. The breach is considered the worst known cyber compromise in the last 5 years. Previously, President Donald Trump suggested the hackers could be from China, but Secretary of State Mike Pompeo quickly said in a radio interview that it was, quote, pretty clear that it was the Russians that engaged in this activity. Meanwhile, President-elect Joe Biden criticized the president's response and has promised an overwhelming focus on the hacks when he assumes office in January.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. U.S. President Donald Trump on Tuesday signed an executive order banning transactions with 8 Chinese software applications, including WeChat Pay and Alipay. Gloria Tsou of Reuters reports.
With less than a month left in office, U.S. President Donald Trump signed an executive order on Tuesday banning transactions with 8 Chinese apps. It targets apps widely used in China, though not as popular in the United States, such as WeChat Pay and Alipay. It's a move sure to ratchet up already high U.S.-China tensions. A senior official told Reuters it's meant to head off the threat posed by Chinese apps, which have large user bases and access to sensitive data. The order claims data collection by Chinese apps would, quote, permit China to track the locations of federal employees and contractors and build dossiers of personal information. A U.S. official says the order gives the Commerce Department 45 days to define which transactions will be banned, but that the department plans to act before Trump leaves office on January 20th. But any new transactions prohibited by the Trump administration are likely to face court challenges similar to when it sought to block transactions with WeChat and TikTok under an earlier order signed in August. That order would have effectively banned the app's use in the United States and barred Google and Apple's app stores from offering them. The Chinese embassy in Washington did not immediately respond to a request for comment.
That's Gloria Tso of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. Hong Kong police have arrested 53 former lawmakers and activists in the largest move against the city's pro-democracy movement since a national security law was imposed last June. A top official said the arrests targeted people suspected of, quote, overthrowing or interfering, unquote, with the Hong Kong government executing its duties. They were accused of subverting state power by participating in unofficial election primaries for the territory's legislature last year. Nearly 2 weeks after most other European nations, the Netherlands on Wednesday began its COVID-19 vaccination program, with nursing home staff and frontline workers in hospitals first in line for the shot. Sana El-Kadiri, a nurse at a home for people with dementia, was the first to receive a shot of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine at a mass vaccination center in Veghel, 120 kilometers southeast of the capital, Amsterdam. A British court has denied bail to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who had been jailed in Britain since 2019, as he fights extradition to the United States. District Judge Vanessa Breitzer on Wednesday ordered Assange to remain in prison, while the courts consider an appeal by U.S. authorities against the decision not to extradite him. On Monday, the judge rejected an American request to send Assange to the U.S. to face espionage charges over WikiLeaks' publication of secret military documents a decade ago. She denied extradition on health grounds, saying the 49-year-old Australian was likely to kill himself if held under harsh U.S. prison conditions.
This is Science in a Minute. Results of a randomized controlled trial provides evidence that infusions of mesenchymal stem cells from umbilical cords can safely lessen the threat of death and hasten the recovery time for patients with severe COVID-19. Mesenchymal stem cells, according to the National Cancer Institute, are cells that develop into connective tissue, blood vessels, and lymphatic tissue. The trial was led by researchers at the University of Miami's Miller School of Medicine. 24 COVID-19 patients with severe acute respiratory distress syndrome, one of the disease's main causes of death, were given two infusions, days apart of each other, of either stem cells or placebos. The researchers report that 91% of those treated with stem cells, compared to 42% who got the placebos, were still alive after 1 month and recovered faster from the disease. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The COVID-19 pandemic has worsened the hunger crisis in Zimbabwe. As store shelves remain empty, some are taking innovative steps to put food on the table. Barry City resident Kurai Felix Mukaro, known as Uncle Bravo, turned an unused soccer field into a garden with dozens of youths to grow crops to feed the elderly. He says the project was born out of desperation for food.
It started with the front line again when they came and they gave us some food packages. And then I said, no, this is an injection that, no, we've got now to start working on our own also and get sustainable from the point of the hampers we have been given. They came and they helped. They gave hampers to some elderly people and also gave hampers to the little children. Now we said, no, this is quite a good baptism that we have been also empowered to do something big for ourselves and our community.
What were you trying to achieve in trying to start this project?
What we were trying to achieve was the poverty which was already getting by in my own community, including within myself. Things were not good when COVID started. We thought now jobs, nothing to do. With my little ones, yeah, I think we can sustain ourselves because we still got the soil and the manure and everything, and we can still do the best we can to make sure we are the ones to help within our community in a big way.
How is the project doing at the moment?
It's doing very well. We didn't have any place to go, but I just go there in the number 7. It's now called number 7 ground. And when we started with just a few beds. Now, I think within that place, we've got about now 15 big beds. And they're doing very well. And through the assistance of frontline as well, we've got a variety of plants like broccoli. We've got cauliflower. We've got red cabbage. We have got now a lot of sweet potato beds. We've got big potato beds coming up there. We've got a rape. We have got also spinach. And now we're having a lot of spinach, which we want to make sure at least if some people can help us buy those things, that would be quite great for ourselves. So I think we have got almost right now beds, which are going almost about 30 beds, which we think we can nurture them properly. What we might need is a market.
How many children are you working with?
The group of children is about 70 I'm working with, but amongst them are some who are quite productive. A small number is quite productive, about 25, 30 are more productive. There are some of them, they were there to give them more motivation, more encouragement, so that eventually at least they can do also something. But amongst these, about 30 have got even beds, which they have started in their homesteads through an arrangement which I actually did with their parents, and they set them some small beds for a start in their homesteads. So I think we've got plants also which we are nurturing from there.
How bad is the food situation and food security in your area?
Not very good, because especially when I'm talking in lines, mostly with some of these vulnerable families, I think they're just surviving through the nature and of God. But I think the situation is not very conducive, because I think they need also certain aid from somewhere. But eventually, I think they're just existing. It's not that good with most of the families. except, of course, those who have got some of their families who are just doing some jobs here and there. But to tell the truth, I think a lot is needed to make sure that at least the sustenance is there in position, especially this time of COVID. I think it has just kept people in certain hopes that something better will come, and it looks COVID is coming and things is creeping back again. It might make it even worse.
That's Kurai Felix Mokaro, known as Uncle Bravo. He spoke with me from Mutare. Even with tough anti-coronavirus measures in place, North Korea has opened a major multi-day political gathering in the capital, Pyongyang. The country's leader, Kim Jong-un, used the forum to acknowledge recent economic failures, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
A global pandemic may be preventing large gatherings worldwide, but you wouldn't know that in Pyongyang on Tuesday. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un addressed a crowd of thousands tightly packed in an auditorium with no masks and no social distancing. His message was not upbeat. Kim admitted the country has immensely underachieved in almost all areas of a recent five-year economic plan. North Korea's economy may have contracted by at least 8% in 2020, according to some estimates. Trade with China, its economic lifeline, plummeted nearly 80%. Combined with continued international sanctions and recent massive floods, 2020 was one of the toughest years yet under Kim's rule. This week, North Korea is expected to set a new economic plan. But analyst Bong Yong-sik says there may not be much the North can do to improve things right now.
There's no end in sight when it comes to North Korea overcoming the COVID-19 pandemics, especially when you consider the medical capacity and the procurement of vaccines. North Korea is really far behind any other countries to get out of this disastrous pandemic.
North Korea insists not a single person in its country has tested positive for the coronavirus, a claim widely disputed by experts. According to a report in the New York-based daily newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, North Korea recently submitted an application to receive COVID-19 virus vaccines. Sanctions, too, are a major concern for North Korea's economy. But North Korea has for months boycotted nuclear talks with the United States. Instead, many analysts expect Kim could soon test a missile or other weapon at the onset of the administration of President-elect Joe Biden. It's part of the Kim family's message of so-called self-reliance, which yet again is a theme at this week's meeting in Pyongyang. Analyst Bong says the meeting is also an attempt by Kim to show that he still has public support, even during challenging times.
Kim Jong-un cannot afford to wait any longer, that he has to show up the unity and the loyalty of the general population through the Eighth Party Congress and the upcoming Supreme People's Assembly with a minimum amount of delay. Otherwise, the legitimacy and the control of the supreme leadership over the general population would be in a critical situation.
During his opening speech Tuesday, Kim did not mention the United States, South Korea, or nuclear issues. The event is expected to last for multiple days. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
A team of Afghan government representatives arrived in the capital of Qatar Tuesday afternoon to resume peace talks with the Taliban. Afghan officials are pushing for a ceasefire in hopes of stopping a wave of attacks on officials and other influential figures. VOA's Aisha Tazim brings us the details.
Negotiations between the Taliban and Afghan government officially started in September, but progress was slow in the first round. After a three-week break, the two sides will start again Wednesday in Qatar's capital, Doha. Mohammad Masoom Stanagzai, the man leading the Afghan delegation, said achieving a ceasefire would be the top priority for his team. Taliban spokesman Mohammad Naim disagreed. There is no specific time frame or order of priority for deciding the ceasefire issue, said Naim. He went on to say that the two sides would discuss the issue, but there was no agreement yet on which issue should come first or which issue should take priority over others. The issue of ceasefire took center stage after violence in Afghanistan surged following a U.S. deal with the Taliban in February. While the insurgent group stopped direct attacks on foreign forces, it increased its targeting of Afghan security forces. Civilians paid a heavy toll as a consequence of the increased fighting. In addition, Afghan and American officials blamed the Taliban for targeting influential individuals, including government officials, journalists, and civil society activists. The peace talks have resumed at a time when the United States is facing a tense presidential transition. If the incoming Joe Biden administration adopts any changes in Afghanistan policy, they will likely impact the peace negotiations. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The European Union's Medicines Agency gave the green light Wednesday to Moderna Inc.'s COVID-19 vaccine, a decision that gives the 27-nation bloc a second vaccine to use in a desperate battle to tame the virus rampaging across the continent. The approval recommendation by the European Medicines Agency's Human Medicines Committee, which must be rubber-stamped by the EU's Executive Commission, comes amid high rates of infections in many EU countries and strong criticism of the slow pace of vaccinations across the region of some 450 million people. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
Joint Issues in the News moderator Dan Raviv and a panel of Washington experts as they deliberate the latest top stories of the week, including 11 Republican senators say they will challenge the outcome of the presidential election when Congress meets next week to certify the Electoral College results. Don't miss Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at The Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on The Voice of America.
Music time, music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.